More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning. Today is Monday, January 6, 2014. You are listening to More Talk Radio here on KBOO, your community radio station, 104.3 in Corvallis, 91.9 in Hood River, and 90.7 FM in Portland, and via the World Wide Web, it's kboo.fm. My name is Cecil Prescott, and we welcome you this morning. Let me give you our contact numbers to join us later in our program. You may join us by calling 503-231-8187, or you may email us at moretalkradio@gmail.com. Before we begin our interview this morning, I want to call your attention to the fact that there is a chance that the House of Representatives will take a vote this week on the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership that many of you are familiar with. And we are urging you to call our your representatives in the House to urge them to say no to fast-track trade authority and no to secret trade deals such as the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Let me give you the number for Representative Bonamici. Her number in Washington is 202-225-0855, or in Oregon, it's 503-469-6010. And Earl Blumenauer, his Washington office number is 202-225-4811, and in Oregon, it's 503-231-2300. So call and urge them to oppose the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and stay tuned here on your community radio station to hear more about how people and communities are organizing against this, another example of corporatism running amok. So thank you for joining us this morning. We are pleased to have with us Dr. David Icard, who is the author of several volumes, including Breaking the Silence Towards a Black Male Feminist Criticism. He's the co-author of Nations of Cowards, Black Activism in Barack Obama's Post-Racial America. His co-author is Martell Teasley, and his most recent volume, on which we will focus on today, is entitled Blinded by the Whites, Why Race Still Matters in 21st Century America. Doctor, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Hey,
good morning.
It's so great
good
to have
morning.
You with us this morning. And are you on sabbatical this academic year?
I'm on sabbatical at Florida State, but I'm actually now in Miami.
Okay.
Ah, weather some heat.
Yeah, the weather's beautiful. It's beautiful.
Well, thank you for joining us this morning, and thank you for being a someone who take time to think about and write about our society. And we wanted to take some time to talk about your most recent volume, but maybe if we could begin, if you just share with us a little bit more about who you are and your development and how you and your focus of studies and writings.
I got into it's real interesting. I never I never set out to be an academic. I come from a small town in North Carolina, from a working class background, and I went to college at North Carolina State University actually to be an engineer. And the first semester I was there, I had some opportunities to take some electives. And one of the electives was African-American literature. I saw, so that'd be interesting. And I had never read a black writer at all in my entire life. In fact, I didn't know that black writers existed in the education that I was given in my small southern town in North Carolina. And I took the class, and I read Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man and Zora Neale Hurston's Our Eyes Are Watching God and all these texts, and James Baldwin, and it just blew my mind. And I was like, what in the world? Why has this been kept from me? This is earth-shattering in terms of my identity, earth-shattering in terms of how I understand my place in the world, my agency in the world. And I talked to my professor and said, how do I become what you are? And she said, you have to get a PhD and so on and so forth. And that's how I set my course in terms of my own academic development. It's just through a kind of love for the literature, but also the way in which the literature spoke to my racial, class, kind of gendered subjectivity, how I moved through the world as a not just a black person, but somebody who's coming from the middle class, and also as a man. How that kind of is informed by the ways in which our society has framed who I am, right? Has framed my identity, and how that plays out in real material spaces, whether we're talking about the prison industrial complex, police brutality, whether we're talking about the disparities in education, whatever. And so my trajectory in terms of my scholarship has really grown out of a kind of real place. Right, a desire to improve the lives of folks who look like me, to empower the lives of folks who look like me, and by extension, all people who are in socially and politically vulnerable situations.
I want to kind of step out here on a limb a little bit. It's really interesting that you had this course of study when you were younger.
Right.
And you read books that had been written, I'm going to hazard a guess, say maybe it minimally 30 years before you were born.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And you found it relevant, and now jump forward years later, and you still talk about the relevancy of the identity offered by these writers long dead. That's ironic, and it's painful.
Yeah.
What triggered a recognition that we're hearing this forward echo, so to speak, of a crisis of identity in terms of what society and the culture offers us?
Oh, that's an excellent question, Celeste. The Faulkner's, William Faulkner's always quoted as saying, the past is not dead, it's not even past, right? Even
right.
Barack Obama did a riff on that in his famous or infamous race speech, where he says, the past is not dead and buried, it's not even past. And I think that's very much how I think about these issues, which is to say that part of the reason that we have so much of the turmoil that we have now, whether we're talking about kind of structural inequalities or race relations or gender inequalities, has to do with the fact that we haven't fully reconciled or reckoned with our past. So our past is always with us. And in order to understand context, you have to have, current day context. You have to have historical context. And I'll give you an example. There's been a whole lot of brouhaha around both fanfare but also political tension around McQueen's excellent movie, 12 Years a Slave. And there have been several folks, including Morgan Freeman, who said, I'm not going to see the movie because it's so painful. And other folks have said, oh, gosh, we have all these movies about slavery. I'm tired of hearing these stories. Let's move on. And somebody like me, when I hear stuff like that, it's pretty stunning, considering that the number of movies that existed in the entire kind of American filmic tradition, you can probably put in one hand, right? You can probably number them. You know, there can't be more than a handful of movies. And when you talk about movies that have actually had the kind of bankroll as some of these kind of blockbuster movies, then there are none. Even 12 Years a Slave was shot in 35 days. I think the budget was a little under $10 million. That's not a blockbuster movie by any stretch of the matter. And it's real interesting, though, that the ways in which we're kind of conditioned, particularly as Black Americans, is to see anything that has to do with our experiences or anything that has to do with slavery in this kind of shameful way. And so what I would argue is that in order for us to understand like our current context, in order to put something like Trayvon Martin's tragic death into context and why somebody like Zimmerman was able to walk away scot-free, or to understand some of the dynamics of you know, the big controversy that happened at Barney's where Jay-Z was called out for you know, peddling his goods after the recent racial profiling dynamic came out. In order to understand the political context of these things, right, you have to understand the historical context and the literature, whether we're talking about Toni Morrison's Beloved or James Baldwin's The Fire Next Time, the literature oftentimes frames this and gives us a way to voice and articulate them in a creative space that often is not available to us in a material space.
You are listening to More Talk Radio here on your Community Connection, KBOO Portland. We're speaking today with Dr. David Eichardt, and we're talking about his book, Blinded by the Whites, Why Race Still Matters in 21st Century America. So we have through literature constructed an identity and deconstructed some of the machinery that oppresses that identity,
mm-hmm.
Both externally and internally. And it's really important to talk about that aspect as well, that the internal oppression. So we take that historical context that you just mentioned, and we kind of stretch it out so that we can see how our consciousness has been shaped by this.
Right.
Okay. So we're in this present moment, and to repeat something that you said earlier about people not wanting to see the movie because they're under the illusion that there's too much of this
out there.
How do we present this information so that the young people today, and I'm talking about the 30-somethings, the 20-somethings, the teens, actually grasp the importance of looking at this and not blinking and not flinching and feeling it? Because I'm going to have to agree with Morgan. It was too painful for me.
Right.
You know,
right,
there was only so much. I didn't think I was going to make it through Amistad.
Right.
You know, I couldn't breathe.
Right. And well, I'm going to tell you, if you couldn't make it through Amistad's list, you're going to have to have a martini this week.
Well, bear in mind, that was then. You know, I've developed a certain thickness of skin and consciousness by now. But, you know, that the reason that it's still so painful, I don't think people understand, is because, like you said, none of this has been resolved.
No, it's raw.
You know, and we're not given the space to discuss it. So we want to discuss it. So, okay, let me broaden it. I'm not going to just say the 30 down. Let's say the 40-somethings, who should be allies because they seek a multicultural expression and environment, yet don't get the importance of discussing this.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you make excellent points. And I think there, you know, I have... you know, it's a complex issue, and so the response is one that is necessarily complex as well. I think on one level, and this is, you know, this also enters into the realm both in terms of, you know, sexuality and class as well, which is to say that, you know, when, and I usually give my students a gender critique, because race is something that, you know, I have to work my way into, because we've been conditioned to be very resistant to have that conversation.
Mm-hmm.
But I tell my students, like, you know, when we hear the issue of rape come up, people tend to associate that with women. They say, well, you know, rape is a woman's issue. And if you talk to a man about, hey, you know, there's going to be, you know, a take back the night, you know, march on campus, or we're going to have this protest, you know, a lot of men are kind of shy away from it because, well, you know, that's not really my issue. Well, in fact, it's primarily a man's issue, mm-hmm. right? In fact, mm-hmm. men are in the best position to actually change the culture of rape because they're the ones who perpetuate it. They're the ones who police it.
Well, right? the truth be told, they're not immune from being a victim
either.
They're
not immune from it, right? You're absolutely right. And I think, but what happens, though, is that in the reality of it, Les, is that if the people who are not the ones who are the chief victims of it don't actually take responsibility for it and actually do the heavy lifting of actually making sure that these issues stay at the forefront of our minds, make sure that the victims of these crimes are protected, are advocated for, so on and so forth, it doesn't get done. And oftentimes that's going to have to exist outside of officially sanctioned bodies. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. on one level in this question about race, what that requires is that folks like myself who are academics also do double duty, right, to make sure that we're both writing the academic stuff and so that the students have both, you know, of all races have access to this kind of discussion on an intellectual and an academic environment, but also be on Twitter, also be on Facebook, also be on Instagram, also have blogs, so that you're also reaching a much broader audience and being able to meet them where they are in the discussion. So that may mean having several discussions about 12 Years a Slave and why that's relevant. That may mean having discussions about Beyoncé's invocation of feminism in her new album. Whatever the case may be, we got to meet the people where they are in this discussion and try to, you know, my biggest push is to try to de-shame the discussion. Mm-hmm. Right? Part of it is we're wearing the shame of our blackness, of this oppression, as if somehow we are deserving of it or somehow we did something to, you know, to create this environment, this crisis that we're in, when in fact the shame should not be on us. The shame should be on the powers, and particularly white supremacist, you know, institutions that have long benefited from these types of black subordination and domination and oppression. And that's the conversation that has to change, and that needs to start with not, you know, with the youngest among us. I mean, I have an 8-year-old and I have an 11-year-old, and I can tell you they've already read Rosa Parks' autobiography. My children memorize, you know, I have them memorize poems by Maya Angelou, by Langston Hughes. We watch documentaries, right? They are mm-hmm. educated culturally. They have some way to think this question through. So when they see a 12 Years of Slavery or see these other kind of representations, they have some kind of critical platform to be able to decipher what it is that they're witnessing so they don't immediately affiliate that with something that is shameful, something that is unspeakable, if that makes any sense.
It certainly does. We're speaking with Dr. David Eichard, is it
Eichard?
Eichard.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
The author of Blinded by the Whites, Why Race Still Matters in the 21st Century. Listening to you, I was also touched by your passion, But in terms of, I think you are illustrative of a different type of academic, and in that you weave in the personal with the more technical aspect of your field of study, which I think is important.
Right.
And so I wonder. Your approach to your field, have you been challenged by this way of creating the narrative, of sharing the story? Have there been any pushback by, well, you shouldn't talk too much about, you know, cultural things such as Beyoncé. You should remain with, you know, something else more academic?
Yeah, again, a great question, Cecil. I think that my response would be to that is that no, I don't have any pushback or very little, and I think it's because the culture in the academy has shifted, particularly as it pertains to folks who do the kind of cultural studies and race studies and gender and sexuality studies that I do. And there is a greater appreciation of the cross-pollination of our scholarship. The reality has been for, particularly for black scholars, whether we're talking about somebody like, you know, Elaine Locke, or we're talking about somebody like, you know, W.E.B. Du Bois, the reality has been that, you know, black academics have always had to be multi-voiced, right? On the one hand, we've had to do the kind of traditional academic stuff to show, hey, we can do that just as well or better than anybody else, right? Any of our white peers can do. So we have to kind of perform on that intellectual level. But at the same time, we are in our communities advocating for the empowerment of our people, because those are our communities. Those are our children. Those are our grandchildren. Those are our aunts and uncles. Those are our neighbors. And so we've always had to do that kind of scholar activism. Most of us have just always kind of organically been engaged in those different communities. But what this current 21st century has offered is a unique opportunity for us to have that conversation, but have that conversation in a more open form that is actually recognized within the academy, so that now you have people like Skip Gates, who are on Twitter, right? Mm-hmm. People like Michael Eric Dyson, who are on Twitter, you know, Cornel West, who are on Twitter, Melissa Sarah Perry, who has her own, you know, talk show, right? So this kind of conflation, this kind of intersection of the intellectual and the political as it concerns black studies and these kind of race studies and cultural studies now have blurred, so that there's now an opportunity for us to have these conversations and have them in a very legitimate way in academic circles. Now, are there not folks who are more traditional who see this kind of cross-pollination, this kind of intersectionality as a problem, who would prefer that we kind of lock the doors in our ivory towers and stay in our lane, so to speak, and not be so kind of outspoken about this? Absolutely, there's still that element. But I would say that that is moving, that's more moving in terms of kind of an older model. Mm-hmm. I think the more contemporary of scholars would not only see these conversations, these discussions as legitimate, but in fact would invite them.
I'd like to talk a little bit more about that, but we want to invite callers to join in the conversation with us.
Sure.
So 503-231-8187, join in the conversation here as we discuss ways to open up and discuss why race still matters in 21st century America and actually beyond, but more importantly, how to deconstruct the opposition and to create an environment where we can address it honestly and with integrity. We'll go to a caller who's been waiting. Good morning, Brian.
Hey, good morning. Well, this is a very full conversation, Doctor. Very interesting. But I'd like to point out a few things there. There's like three points I want to make. Is if you read any interviews with Garcia Marquez, he actually based a lot of his most important writing on Faulkner's style and his concepts of society and all that, and it's been labeled magic realism, you know, and he developed that idea. But, you know, along with that, you know, if you go into the Caribbean, these issues that we've been trying laboriously to address for so long are being addressed every day in literature down there. You know, if you look at Jamaica Kincaid, and I'm a little dated on this, and Edward Dendicott and people like that, there's tons of authors just publishing constantly. And I didn't see 12 Years a Slave. I saw Armistead. I'm on your side on the fact that it was just, you know, it's just so hard to deal with it. And the fact is for people who have dealt with it, it's a reenactment. It's almost PTSD. But the major point I want to make is, if you look outside of the U.S. into South America, into Europe, you know, the issues that we're just not even dealing with and not able to deal with are issues that we're way behind. And I think the fault is, in a major respect, is you look at the Koch brothers, they are descended, and they are not afraid to say that they believe in the John Birch ethics. Getting into any company, and as a predominantly white man, you do not get anywhere without being racist. The incidents at Macy's and all these major stores are no surprise to me. I worked for Macy's in 99, and I left because, you know, I mean, there are security procedures against black people. And, I mean, this is just really normal behavior, and it's perpetuated in American society. And I don't think it's going to change until we, you know, we have to remove racism from our society. And part of that is relieving the Koch brothers and their millions and billions of dollars that they're putting into, and Fox News, active racial, you know, I mean, they're perpetuating this whole racial stereotype and racial divide.
Okay, let's get some response. Okay, thank you so much.
Sorry, it's a mouthful.
Oh, no, that's great.
Yeah, no, okay. Thank you, Brian.
You guys have a great day.
You too.
Okay, bye.
So what do you think of the points that Brian was making?
Well, you know, Brian, he brought up a lot of stuff, and I'll try to kind of touch on some things that I think are, you know, that I can speak to relative to the many issues that he raised. I think it's important to, and I'll strike an optimistic note here. There is if you do surveys, you will see a major divide in terms of racial attitudes from those people who are considered the millennials,
mm-hmm.
right, versus, you know, folks of my generation in terms of, you know, me being, you know, 41. This is what Mark Anthony Neal would call the post-soul generation, those folks who were born at the tail end of the civil rights movement, Ford, and, of course, those folks in the Great Generation and so on and so forth, is that if you talk to my students, for example, their racial attitudes are much more elastic, much more expansive. They're much more willing to engage in critique, right? They're much less biased. And so you see, like, you know, for them, something like having a black president or having a female president, or even having a president who is openly gay, it's not a major deal. It's not a big issue. I think what we see in terms of this kind of white power corporate dynamic, it's really, in some ways, a very reactive dynamic, because what they're witnessing, it's really a sea change in how the next generation is actually seeing race. And there's a lot of anxiety about what that means mm-hmm. to these kind of dominant white notions of what is normal and real and desirable in terms of America. So on the one hand, this, you know, this is absolutely afoot, right? This corporate mm-hmm. kind of movement to try and, right, continue to that legacy of institutionalized white supremacy. That's still very much in play. But at the same time, it does matter that there are folks like myself who are writing about this, who are talking about this, both in traditionally academic settings, but also on Twitter and other kinds of things. There is a movement afoot in this way. And so I think, as much as it continues to be these huge economic disparities and poverty and education are real major crisis issues in black and brown communities, at the same time, there are opportunities, and I do remain optimistic, because I do see attitudes changing.
So let me ask you to expand a little bit more on that point, because clearly the corporate powers, the powers that be, are not just going to go away or raise
not.
Up, and they have a way of morphing in terms of how they continue to control.
Right.
And so sometimes I think we can have a tendency to think, oh, things are changing. You know,
right.
2008, there was that surge of optimism, and then suddenly people were surprised that there was this pushback immediately.
Right.
How do we remain or maintain the optimism that you say that you have, but yet at the same time be realistic about the challenges that we face and how we must combat, if we want to use those type of war terminology, the powers that be?
Yeah, I mean, you know, look, you know, I think those war terminologies are absolutely appropriate to the conversation. If you have somebody like Trayvon Martin who can walk across, you know, the yard of a community in which he lives with some candy in his pocket and end up dead and end up being the one that's on trial, why somebody who, like a George Zimmerman, who's clearly a violent, emotionally disturbed person, can walk around free and still have gun permits and still, you know, wave his guns at his girlfriends and still be a free man, is absolutely apropos. It is, you know, this is not a playground, right? There are real stakes and real people are dying, and these attitudes, the ideas that we have about who people are, can be lethal. And so I think those references, those are absolutely apropos. Let me touch on a couple things that you said. I wrote a book with Martell Teasley about black activism in Barack Obama's post-racial America, because a lot of that hype that was around Barack Obama was actually romanticized, right?
It was, yes.
You know, we never lived in a post-racial environment. And the fact that Barack Obama was able to rise to the level that he was able to rise was not because so much that there was just like overwhelming sea change in how all of America had fought, but it was the coalition of younger college-age students, African-Americans, and Latinos as a coalition, right, is what ushered Barack Obama in. His opponent, McCain, actually won a significant majority of white voters. They just didn't have the numbers, right? So it was really the Browning of America to a large degree that won the day for Barack Obama. But we also have to understand, too, that part of Barack Obama's political strategy was to actually subordinate his race, to play his race down, to in fact say, I am a candidate who happens to be black. And so don't think of me as a black candidate. Think of me as you, right? Think of me as any other kind of candidate. And literally, what we know is that his handlers were that was very much their strategy. That was very much, it wasn't happenstance that's how that played down. That's why I think when Obama got into office, there were a lot of black folks who were very disappointed, because they just assumed that suddenly he'd get in the space and he'd be pro-black and he'd be addressing black issues. Well, the reality is there's no way that those folks who write the big checks, who are in a position to actually put somebody like Barack Obama in a serious contention for the presidency, would have ever bankrolled somebody that was actually going to change the status quo. And so I think that was about being politically naive on one end, and also the power of kind of symbolic capitalism for people of color who are not accustomed to seeing somebody that looks like us in such a powerful position. Now, to the second point, in terms of, like, you know, how do we remain sober about the challenges that are still ahead, even as we, you know, hold out optimism? I think that the thing that I see happening when these numbers are dwindling for some of these powerful, you know, white representatives, is that what they're doing is they're recruiting people of color to be the new kind of white class, right? Mm-hmm. So, in other words, the way you increase your number when you literally don't have the physical numbers is you recruit model minorities, right? You recruit these folks who are black and brown, and you say, look, you know, you can be in the club, but hey, this is how you get in the club. Is that I'll give you a piece of the pie, but you got to maintain the status quo, right? So, you know, these are the Don Lemons of the world, right? Mm-hmm. These are the Charles Barkleys of the world. I mean, to be quite
Jay-Z's frankly. Jay-Z's of the world.
Yeah, absolutely.
Call it out.
hey, I mean, it is. And so, you know, it's, you know, and so, and they roll these folks in front when, you know, we have a Trayvon Martin tragedy or whatever to go, oh, no, black folks are just overreacting. Brown folks are just overreacting. You know, this is, you know, he should have been polite. He shouldn't have been aggressive with George Zimmerman, even though the guy grabbed him by the arm. You know, he should have said, sir, I'm sorry, I'm in your space and da, 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 da. Right. So, you know, that's why I'm also, if you know, and blinded by the whites, that I also take on, like, the ways in which, you know, elite black folks are becoming, and also in the Nation of Cowards book, these elite black folks are like, they don't want to talk about the prison industrial context. They don't want to talk about black poverty. What they want to talk about is affirmative action. The reason why they want to talk about affirmative action, because affirmative action affects whether or not they get a partnership in a firm, whether or not they get tenure, because it's a middle class, upper middle class issue that affects their middle class constituency. Right. And so that's the other kind of tricky negotiation that is going on for folks in the 21st century that we have to be aware of as a new frontier of power.
Excellent.
You are listening to More Talk Radio here on your Community Connection, KBOO Portland. Join the conversation as we speak with Dr. David Eichard of Why Race Still Matters in the 21st Century and how to honestly talk about the issue and deconstruct the walls that separate us. 503-231-8187. We'll go to our next caller. Good morning, Francis. Francis? You might want to turn your radio down.
Of course, I don't know. A lot of people have... Hello?
You may want to turn your radio down. Turn your radio down.
It is down.
Okay.
My radio is down.
Okay, good. Now we
can hear me.
Yes.
Thank you. A lot of people have been talking about this for years and years and years, and I myself have been viewed as a troublemaker when I bring it up in different venues and in different discussions. And we don't need to just say Charles Barkley or, you know, Jay-Z, but the prison guard, the person who works as a police officer, people who promote the probation and parole programs that stigmatize young African Americans, everyone who is doing a job to earn a living that is part of this system. I don't know how we can stop it without everyone just standing up and saying, I'm not going to do this anymore. Everyone is compromised at some level and allows this, for example, the prison industrial complex to just continue to grow at the expense of young people.
Mm-hmm.
And I appreciate your conversation. And do you guys remember when President Clinton started this conversation, and then for some reason his town hall meetings and everything just stopped?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember why that happened, why they stopped?
I don't recall.
No, right. I can't say I do either.
But I appreciate that you're having this discussion. We've had this discussion in my memory for 40 years, and I still see young people sitting in isolation in a prison with no one and nobody there to help them. And I don't know how to stop that cycle.
Certainly.
But I do appreciate that we're talking about it. But it isn't just the movie stars and Charles Barkley that are allowing this to continue. It's everybody that has a job in that system that allows it to continue.
Absolutely. I mean, she makes excellent points. I certainly wanted to, you know, to acknowledge that and to point out that one of the reasons that I call out those folks are because they represent a kind of corporate interest. Right. In terms of, you know, who they speak for, because basically what happens is you these folks become stand in for Black America. And that's how that works. So, yes, the Tyrones and the Ray Rays and the Davids and the, you know, Lakeishas are also we all have a vested interest in this. And some of us are very much complicit in its maintenance. But it's also important to call out how that gets played out in a kind of a larger
in the corporate. As far as I can see, you know, and as I said, I've been struggling with this for years, trying to figure out what would be the best way to provide some kind of a catalyst or a spark for this to stop. Mm-hmm. You know, and like I agree that we need to at least talk about it and acknowledge it.
Right.
But I do see that the corporate monster is probably one of the worst culprits there is. So I do appreciate that the 99% and that stuff is going on because they do acknowledge the role there. And I would like to comment on a book that I read a long time ago. It's called The Hidden Wound.
Mm.
And it was written by a descendant of a slave owner. And his insight into how the topic is not discussed and how he felt that it needed to be discussed so it could be brought into the light and we could acknowledge and sort of like they did in South Africa.
Okay.
Truth and reconciliation. Mm. You got to tell the truth first.
Got to tell the truth. Well, and the other thing,
thanks,
too, the other thing, too, I would add is that that's why we got to see 12 Years a Slave. That's why we got to have these
right.
conversations because,
exactly.
you know, I joke about this. I'm writing about this now in a current project that I'm working on. A friend of mine, a Nigerian born friend of mine had a son who was in first grade and he came home one day. It was, you know, February. And so they're, you know, the only month that they teach anything about black folks, right?
Mm-hmm.
So he came home and said, you know, says, Dad, you know, I learned some black history today. And I said, well, tell me, what'd you learn, son? He says, I learned that Martin Luther King freed the slaves.
Oh, my goodness.
Right, he freed the
my
slaves.
My goodness sake.
Right? And so, and what's striking about that in its complete absurdity, right, is that, kids conflate things, they confuse things. But the way in which we teach black history, Martin Luther King might as well have freed the slaves mm-hmm. because we don't get into any
right.
kind of depth. We don't get, I mean, they're interchangeable. Rosa Parks, Martin Luther King, right? The people, you know, the people that are acceptable, mm-hmm. you know, to talk about. We don't talk about Malcolm X. We don't talk about Marcus Garvey, right?
It was not acceptable to talk about Nelson Mandela when he was called
Nelson
a terrorist.
Mandela. Absolutely.
That's right.
mm-hmm. Absolutely.
He
and
was
then,
a terrorist.
And
that was a taboo thing to talk about.
That was a taboo oh. thing to talk about. And the fact of the matter is, what changed America in terms of civil rights and race relationships was actually black radicalism, right? Radicalism,
right.
not. Mm-hmm. I mean, Martin Luther King was a radical. He was. You know, they brought him. You know that famous line where he's. You know, the when they're spying on him and they're talking to the head of the CIA and they say, "We have not yet. We need to label Martin Luther King as the most dangerous man in America," right?
Right.
And now we teach. Martin Luther King, as if somehow he's a Santa Claus,
right?
Yes.
Well, thank you,
know.
You Francis.
So what bothers me?
Well, Francis, we have another caller, and I'm sorry, I have to let you go. But I want to thank you so much for an excellent point of bringing it down to the here and now, and the everyday that we still have to struggle. Thank you so much. We'll go to our next caller. Good morning, Harriet.
Hey, good morning. I'm sorry, I'm just sort of tuning in late, but I was just reading Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States, and there was this, insightful position that when early on in the, 1600s, 1700s, when African-American slaves, when poor whites, when Native Americans were beginning to come together and create a sort of a sense of a rebel force, a rebellion against the elite understood that one of the sort of protections was to create a middle class, mm-hmm. to create the idea that if you wanted to, you could be entered into the elite class, which of course never was true. And it's proven itself out to be what it is, which is sort of just a little buffer between the working or poor and the elite, or the 99% and the 1%. So that's a very old sort of tactic. But what I also wanted to say is that there is a way in which all of our participation in the sort of capitalist system, it's very subtle that we are all participating in, and it lures us all. So where do we draw the line? And this is I'm sort of speaking on personally as having tried to deconstruct the effect of my own privilege in my life, and that is everything from, you know, where I shop, how I assume my food should be delivered to me, how I assume, you know, everything, resources should be handled, that there is a really slippery slope for everybody in terms of our entitlement. And where does it begin and where does it start? So in that respect, my own personal life is very focused on, you know, well, for me, it's, you know, food systems, and I think about what we've done to the planet, and I think about my role as a consumer, and my whether or not I am a consumer in an economy or a citizen in a society, and all that. So that sense of what are we all participating in, and where the sort of blood on all of our hands, and this invitation into this, the good life, what we call the good life, and that as a tool of the elite to sort of sedate us all into a sense of, I don't know if the word complicity or a sense of comfort. And I, you know, so I like I said, I just tuned in late, and I'm not only speaking it, and this is more particularly from the perspective of the African community, African American community, and what happens when you're invited into it, and then how do we no longer speak truth to power, but I think that it exists all over, and I think we are all sort of fighting against each other as opposed to what is the real issue at hand, is that 1% that has had control of land, of resources, of power, of all from the get-go. And okay. So that's what I'm hoping happens, is that we all begin to recognize that we are the people, and the 1% is, but it's a game plan. It's
okay, well, let's have the professor respond to the points you raised, Harriet. Thank you.
Yeah, excellent. Excellent points. I think, again, and this goes back to an excellent question that Celeste had raised about the past and the present. The caller brings up an excellent point about the fact that, again, the things that we're dealing with today in terms of structural inequalities and institutional racism are not new, but basically remixes of things that we've dealt with all along. And I'd like to make a comment about how it is that a lot of working class whites, the middle class whites, actually working against their best interest because of race. Because, in fact, this middle class that she speaks of, she's talking about things like the Bacon Rebellion, and which what a lot of people don't know is that, you know, in the kind of the history of the building of this America, before we had the, you know, the Revolutionary War and became our own country, that the ways in which a lot of poor whites got passage over here was through white indentureship. Basically, they sold their labor and their rights to the wealthy elite in order to, like, you know, as credit to get over here. And they were treated as just little better than the African captives who were working oftentimes alongside them. But the problem was that in that particular moment, the aristocrats made up a very small percentage of the population. The white indentures and the African captives made up the majority of the population, and they needed those white indentured servants to actually protect them from the indigenous population of what we call now Native Americans, right? And so they were armed, and what they realized really quickly is that the African captives and the white indentured folks realized that the real problem was the ways in which they were being exploited by the elite. And they formed coalitions that actually overthrew the elite. And literally you had people, they had to call in folks, you know, armies from across the seas to come in and quell those, you know, like you look up like things like the Bacon Rebellion. They had to literally call in, you know, the troops from Great Britain to come in and quell these insurrections. And what they had to ultimately do is give the white working class and lower middle classes a carrot. And that carrot was the ability to have dominance over black folks.
So one of the things that they took away was the ability to indenture white people. So the only people that could be indentured, the only people that could be slaves, were black people. And so by virtue of pushing them further down the ladder, they actually created a kind of symbolic representation of white privilege that lower and middle class white people have hung on to. And what happens is, because of that, politicians like Ronald Reagan, right? Remember the Ronald Reagan Democrats, actually play upon that racism to actually get many of these groups to operate against their best economic issues. And I would say my final point here to the caller's question about what we can do today, I would say we have to stand with those folks who are demanding a livable wage. Those people who are protesting at fast food places like McDonald's, those folks who are protesting at places like Walmart, right? We have to call those out. We have to boycott those spaces. We can't, you know, we can't go, oh my gosh, you know, I'm with those people and order a Big Mac or do our shopping at Walmart. We have to put our money where our mouth is. Our politics have to line up. It doesn't mean you have to be anti-capitalism. It doesn't mean you have to give up your car, right? But it does mean that, you know, if, hey, maybe you need to shop somewhere where the food costs more or it costs $2 more, whatever the case may be, because ultimately you're willing to spend more because the company is actually taking care of their employees, right? Because right, if you're shopping at these places, let's be very clear, if you're shopping at places like McDonald's and Walmart, you're part of the problem.
We're speaking with Dr. David Icard, author of Blinded by the Whites, Why Race Still Matters in 21st Century America, published by Indiana University Press. We have about 4 more minutes. Let's see if we can get to one last caller before we wrap up. Good morning, Brian.
Good morning. Hey, thanks for taking me. And I just wanted to actually call and sort of another thank you call to KBOO for this conversation, which seems to me like a conversation from some of the coverage that you gave to the Mandela funeral some weeks ago.
Actually, this was the guest we were hoping to have, so you're right on point.
Okay.
Yes.
I remember some years ago I read Howard Zinn's book and Naomi Klein's book, and it made me have a different take, started making me have a different take on the apartheid in South Africa. You know, and then when Nelson Mandela passed away, you guys had on KBOO, I shouldn't say you guys, but KBOO had coverage and interviews with some people that kind of filled out the story for me about how that was pulled off, and it seemed to and what you were talking about this morning reminded me of that, how they played the game, how the big money played the game, and how apartheid played the game. And I remember it finished the story for me, because I remember in Naomi Klein's book, it had a quote in there where they said that, yeah, when they got power, the ANC got power, it was like they got the keys to the house but not the keys to the safe. And then some of the interviews that later on that you guys played just a couple weeks ago kind of filled out the story, and it seems to say exactly what you're saying today.
Mm. Very, very good. And as in terms of race and the points of how we don't understand the full dimension of what liberation means, and as the professor mentioned earlier, it's a wide, a much deeper struggle that we need to be careful of, lest we be sucked into the system itself.
Right, and it seems like whenever there's too much of a feel good story in the media today, you got to look a little deeper.
Right. Absolutely.
Thank you.
Thank you for your call. So there are a lot more topics in your book that we haven't even touched on. And I want to just tell you right now, we'd like to invite you back to discuss some of those, because there's issues of dealing with black feminism and black men. There's issues of dealing with the way that young black men are I guess I should say, prevented from reaching maturity. And then just the whole idea of embracing an idea of beauty that's not predicated on white beauty.
Yeah,
so,
colorism.
You know, so much more to discuss in the book so that we can enrich people and give them their particular vibe in this battle to resonate and to work and move forward with. But in closing, what would you like people to take from the limited discussion that we have? We got about a minute.
Yeah, what I wanted to, I want people to realize that they're as overwhelming a task that is before us and as overwhelming as it seems in terms of seeing, you know, black and brown folks being treated as the way they are and some of the problems in education and prison industrial complex, that we see there is a silver lining, that struggle, that collective struggle does matter. Activism does matter. Calling your politicians, agitating, protesting, those things do matter. And so we have to hold out hope, and our hope has to be critical. And if we maintain that, then things will change. But we have to always remain vigilant, and we have to always push forward and remember that we have gotten here on the shoulders of giants who believed as well and who fought as well.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. David Icard, and we hope to have you back soon so we can continue this conversation.
Absolutely.
Thank you for your great work.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you.
And you're listening to Your Community Connection, KBOO Portland. Stay tuned. We have coming up at 9 o'clock the Old Mo Variety Hour, featuring news, views, and interviews. Also, stay tuned because we have Health Watch coming up. We have at 11, at 10:15, Locust Focus. At 10 o'clock, Chris Andre with Air Cascadia. 11:30, Madness Radio has guest David Edward Walker, who will talk about the legacy of colonialism and how it impacts Native American mental health today. Thank you so much, KBOO members, for your support in 2013, and we appreciate your membership to help KBOO stay strong in 2014 and beyond.
The KBOO Community Radio Artist in Residence Program assists artists working creatively with sound. Every year, one artist or one collaborative group of artists will be awarded 20 hours of studio recording and production time with a KBOO mixologist in order to create a piece of sound art that will be publicly presented at the end of the residency. The Artist in Residence Program is open to artists of all disciplines whose project proposals include sound as a major component. The deadline to apply to be the 2014 KBOO Artist in Residence is February 14th. More information on the Artist in Residence program, including eligibility, selection process, and the application, can be found at kboo.fm/AIR2014.
I wish I was mold in the ground. I wish I was mold in the ground. If I was mold in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. I wish I was mold in the ground. Well, I wish I was a bird in the sky. I wish I was a bird in the sky. If I was a bird in the sky, I could be high all the time. Yeah, nobody would pay me any mind. Well, I don't like that old Johnny Law. I don't like that old Johnny Law. Well, I don't like that old Johnny Law. Don't you know he'll punch me in my jaw all the time. I'm going down the road feeling fine, oh Lord. I'm going down the road feeling fine. I don't got a dollar or a dime, oh, you know I'm feeling fine. I wish I was a bird in the sky. I wish I was a bird in the sky. I wish I was a bird in the sky. If
If I was a bird in the sky, you couldn't read me my rights. So I wish I was a bird in the sky.
You are tuned to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland. Portland's only community-owned, democratically run, non-commercial, volunteer-driven radio station. I'm your host and engineer, Joe Clement. The Old Mole is self-produced by a collective of agitators, educators, and organizers. As a variety hour, we offer interviews with thinkers and doers, reviews of books and film, untold stories of oppression and resilience, and our own personal brand of Commie Terry, the well-read red. You can find past programs and segments full of links and other goodies by going to our website, kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. Bill Resnick starts us off today talking with Howie Hawkins, a labor activist and Green Party candidate in New York. Howie describes his class struggle experiences working as a UPS worker over the years and being a part of the Teamsters Union and an advocate of Teamsters for a Democratic Union, as well as a Green Party candidate in Democrat-controlled New York, especially upstate New York. 20 years ago, the North American Free Trade Agreement was passed, and boy howdy has it sucked. In that same year, 1994, the Zapatista Army of National Liberation was formed. Espousing a revolutionary mix of indigenous rights, feminism, and anarchism, as well as socialism, the Zapatistas have been in a declared war with the Mexican state since then. Well-read Red, Fran Michel, looks at how this conflict is being remembered, fought, and supported today. In the second half of the hour, I'll read an excerpt from another one of Peter Frace's Jacobin Magazine articles about basic income, non-reformist reforms, and utopian thinking on the capitalist road to communism. It's an article titled Curious Utopias. And finally, to finish the show, Denise Morris will be talking with Yasmin Nair, a regular Old Mole guest and writer based in Chicago with the Against Equality Collective. They will be talking about queer and trans struggles in an era when the acceptance of homosexuality seems to be gaining traction, and how hate crime legislation has evolved in the wakes of several deaths, including the 20-year-ago murder of Brandon Tina, a trans man. And they'll be focusing on how the economic, racial, and sexual inequalities that prevail in these times perpetuate quote-unquote hate-based violence, and how they may be underlooked in the way that that legislation is brought to the public. But you are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on 90.7 FM in Portland. I am your host, Joe Clement. We are now just going to jump right in with Bill Resnick and Howie Hawkins.
Howie Hawkins, welcome to KBOO.
Good to be here.
Howie Hawkins is a worker, organizer, a writer, a speaker. He co-founded the Clamshell.